Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
Summer is winding down and kids are going back to school, but politics in Iowa are as hot as ever. It's a special Pints and Politics edition of River to River, presented by the Gazette and Iowa Public Radio. Coming to you tonight from Millstream Brewing in Amana, I'm Erin Jordan. Ben Kiefer is away tonight. So tonight, we've got a lot to talk about. More shootings in the country lead to a new round of gun control conversations. We're going to talk about farm bailouts, candidates at the Iowa State Fair, and we've got our great panel. So wait till the end till we get applause. I know they all deserve it. But here we've got Adam Sullivan, Gazette columnist, James Lynch, Gazette political reporter, Todd Dorman, Gazette insights and opinion editor, and for the first time on our panel, Liz Lenz, new Gazette columnist. So Liz, your website says you are a writer, author, and a whiskey drinker. But I assume that beer's okay tonight?
Yeah, beer's fine, I guess.
All right.
No, it's so delicious here at Millstream. Who could turn it down?
So you started with the Gazette last week, and a few days before that, you published a book, Godland. That's, a pretty amazing week. I just wanted to ask, can you tell us a little bit about your book?
I would love to tell you a little bit about my book. It's a story of faith, loss, and renewal in Middle America. So what happened was, right before the election, my church failed and my marriage failed, and then I felt like our country failed, kind of all together at the same time, and I wanted to know what was going on. So I took a couple years and traveled around the Midwest, going to different centers of faith, conferences and churches, a lot of them small and closing up in rural areas, but also I went to, bigger cities to investigate what was happening there too. And so I wrote a book about it. I wrote a book about the way that faith is so personally tied to who we are as a people, as Americans, and how we live our lives and how we do our politics. So that's my book.
I can imagine that when you start a new job at the Gazette or anywhere else as a columnist, you have some burning issues that you're kind of eager to explore. I was wondering if you could share some of those with us.
I would like to reveal just how bad Todd Dorman's puns are. I don't think it gets enough press, and I think we need a real investigation.
Everybody here knows. They know.
They know.
I should interview them. Please.
I will interview all of you for my in-depth investigation as to why he's still writing puns. I can't work under these conditions. Other issues I'd love to tackle when I'm finished with that one. I write a lot about faith. I write a lot about feminism. I write a lot about intersectional issues that deal with race and gender. And I also really, really love Iowa. So I want to write all of that and whatever else I want. So.
That sounds great. And this is from a non-Iowa native saying she loves Iowa. So
I grew up in Texas, but actually Iowa is now the place I've lived in the longest, by 6 months now. So yeah, you have to accept me as one of your own because Texas will not allow me back right now.
Well, we're glad to, and I want to thank you for joining us tonight. We're going to have a great conversation. In the last several weeks, we have had mass shootings in El Paso, Dayton, Gilroy, California. This has brought about a new push for gun controls. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell says he'd allow consideration of legislation in the fall. What kind of bill do you think we might see out of that?
I'm really skeptical that the House and the Senate could come together and pass really anything, certainly anything big and meaningful. It was interesting, though, you've seen recently Senator Chuck Grassley came out in favor of red flag laws. But really, the devil's in the detail on that. There's a lot of different ways you might construct a red flag law. His quote specifically was talking about banning certain people from purchasing new firearms. And some people want to go ahead and confiscate firearms. I think there's a lot of ways to do that in a really messy way. There may be a couple ways to do it in a workable way. But we have a lot of guns in the country. You know, you will need SWAT teams and stuff in some of these situations to go take people's guns. So I'm not sure that has a real impact on the mass shootings. It might have some impact on the other gun violence, which is a much more pervasive issue. It's probably frustrating to a lot of people, but I don't think that anything probably gets done before the next election, at least.
Like Adam, I'm skeptical that anything big will get done. The red flag law seems to be something that a lot of people agree on, especially if there's due process in it, that people's guns aren't just confiscated because I say Adam might be a danger to himself or others, but that there's a process there. Background checks, there's quite a bit of support for that, but I don't know if it's a majority yet.
I see a lot of really hopeful talk on both sides of the aisle about getting assault rifles out of the hands of, you know, Americans who want to kill other people. But again, it seems so unlikely that any of this will happen before another election, because the NRA's money is so influential and so pervasive and controls so many of our politicians that seems to me to be the real, you know, one of the real controlling issues. And it's hard to take that money out of the equation.
Well, and I agree. I think the president is key. If he would actually push something that Republicans could then get behind, then you might see some progress. I don't think that's going to happen. I think, you know, talking about debating it in the fall, I think with every day or week that passes, it's going to become more difficult as we get closer to the election. Both sides are going to raise money on this. They're going to fight about this. Republicans in particular are going to be sensitive to the possibility of primary challenges or others that will, you know, politic on this issue, campaign on this issue. So I think there's some good intentions, probably more than have been in the past, but I'm with everyone as far as being skeptical that something's actually going to get passed.
I think one of the things to watch for, though, is what not necessarily the NRA does, but gun owners do. I think we had an editorial last week challenging gun owners to speak up. Governor Steve Bullock yesterday kind of had the same message to gun owners, telling them they need to speak up.
Well, and we got a few calls to the Opinion Factory on that particular editorial, as you might imagine, and a lot of them were gun owners who believe that any of these steps are basically going to lead them down the road to that confiscation of guns. At least that's what the critics of this editorial were saying, and that's, you hear that. But
it's such a red herring, I think, to think that guns will actually ever be completely illegal in America, because guns are so intimately tied to who we are conceptually as Americans. It's like, it's just a slippery slope kind of logical fallacy to say, okay, controlling guns so children don't die in schools will somehow enable you to stop hunting. And I wish that rhetoric would stop, you know, because it's really preventing us from saving lives. And I grew up in Texas. I was an NRA member at the age of 10. I won my membership in a competition. I shot 2-1 with a French dueling pistol. Thank you. And what I'm trying to say is, like, you don't hear, even from the most liberal of presidential candidates, you don't hear a lot of rhetoric about, like, no more guns in America, that's it. You hear a lot of common sense solutions, but it's hard to hear them through the mass hysteria of the red herring arguments of, oh no, then we'll have no more guns. And while we deal with that, people die. So it sucks.
The conversation has shifted, though. I mean, you have a lot of politicians talking about confiscating weapons, not banning weapons outright. The government loves guns. They would never get rid of guns altogether. They need guns to be a government. But, you know, confiscating weapons is much more popular now than it was 10 years ago. And if you talk to the really hardcore gun people, they see the NRA as a watered down, a compromising group. They don't support the NRA. There's these people out there. I don't know if it's more than 10% of Americans. It's probably not. But they're really hardcore. They think that any gun law is an infringement on their fundamental rights. And so the money does make some impact. But the bigger thing is, in Republican districts, there is a sizable number of people who are one-issue voters, and it's gun rights absolutism. And if you have enough members of the House that are from those districts, then they're never going to go along with that. but I don't know.
So moving to another big issue this week, and I have a couple questions from the audience along these lines. So U.S. Representative Steve King, who represents Iowa's 4th District, made national news earlier this week with statements questioning whether there would be any population in the world without children conceived by rape or incest. His intent, I guess, was to defend his decision to not exempt rape or incest from an anti-abortion bill. But I wondered if you could talk a little bit about how these comments have been interpreted overall.
I mean, I don't think there's any other way to interpret them. I mean, even if you look at the full context of his comments, they actually get worse because the whole conversation happened where he was like defending the last horrible racist thing he said and then launched into this next thing. I think what is really the deal with Steve King is he reveals the deep, rotten underbelly of America's racism. He's embarrassing. He says horrible things, but he's also not going away anytime soon. And so we have to deal with him because that's part of who we are, I guess.
And I would point out, I mean, he said it in just a terrible way, but no abortion without exception is in the state Republican Party platform. It's in the national Republican Party platform. So like Liz said, he's articulating it in a really gross way that even some Republicans feel uncomfortable about. But that policy position is not out of line with the Republican grassroots. But the point I try to make to people is even if you agree with Steve King on the issues, even if you're dead set against abortion, how can you conclude that he's a good advocate for your side? And so if you're a Republican in that district who has a very conservative set of views, why would you want that to be your guy in Washington?
Well, and the fact that that's where the Republicans have moved over a long period of time on abortion to no exceptions. I mean, it used to be there were bills and there would be exceptions for health of the mother, life of the mother, rape and incest. So that was fairly common. It's changed a lot over the last 20 years. And the fact that that's the position begs the question as to how much this is actually going to hurt him in a primary campaign in his district. He's got primary challengers, and Randy Feenstra, his toughest challenger, made the same point that you made, that he's a poor advocate for this issue, saying what he says. But this is, you know, where are the voters at? Where are they at on Steve King? And is he really articulating a position that they're basically okay with?
I mean, I think it's so, like, it's so problematic to say, like, okay, this is the policy position. He just says it in a way that's like bad. Like the policy is bad if that's the articulation of it. I mean, I think instead of just like pushing him away, and I think Republicans should grapple with it a little bit more because that's a real strain in the party right now, and you can't just pretend it away. Steve King vocalizes what a lot of people think, and just because it's not polite, I mean, I don't like it, but just because it's not polite, you can't just say, oh, if only he used nicer words, then that would make it better. Like, sugar the poison pill, fine, but it's still a bad policy.
So the presidential race has been really busy in Iowa lately, but today, John Hickenlooper, the former governor of Colorado, announced he is dropping out of the presidential race and saying he might run for Senate.
Yay.
So, well, my question was going to be how many Democrats are cheering, and I think I heard some in the audience. Wanted to ask you, James, do you have a sense of why some Democrats might be supporting this decision?
Well, for one thing, we're 24 actively campaigning Democrats in this field. It's too many for most people to get their arms around or their head around. And for months now, we've heard Iowa Democrats saying, you know, some of these people need to drop out. And Hickenlooper, for example, that he should run for the Senate. Steve Bullock should run for the Senate in Montana. We've heard that argument for a long time. Hickenlooper has not shown a lot of interest in the Senate. He's an executive and doesn't show a great interest in being part of the herd. However, he said he's going to consider it. I think he's showing that he's realistic. I talked to him Friday night and he said, you know, we did some events today. We had 40 people there. You know, that's not 80. That's not 100. It's not 500. But it's 40 people. So, he knew where he was in this field and what the response to him was. He's being realistic, which is a good thing in a candidate. You know, as Kenny Rogers said, you got to know when to fold them. And he's making, you know, probably the best decision for him.
I liked him better than a lot of them in the field. But what confuses me is if I was really wealthy and I owned beer companies and I lived in a state with legal cannabis, the last thing I would do is run for president. I would do anything else with my time. I would stay home and just enjoy myself and be rich. And
so who do we think's next? Who do we think might drop out next?
I mean, literally any of the white men whose names I can't remember right now.
Maybe it's his buddy Michael Bennett. I don't know.
I mean, you look at this field, and there are a lot of people who aren't even getting 1% in the polls. You know, you're waiting for that chance, you know, to break out. I don't think it's going to happen for most of these people. That's not the way the process tends to work. But there aren't a whole lot of reasons to drop out. Iowans have created this process that says, hey, stick around. You got a Wing Ding, you got an Iowa Hall of Fame, you got the State Fair, you got the Sizzler up in Spirit Lake, you've got the JJ
pork chops
dinner.
Are real good.
Yeah.
Stick around.
Yeah. And the media loves coming here to cover you, so what's the point of getting out? It doesn't take a lot of money. You don't have to organize these events. The party or somebody else organizes it for you. You just show up, give a speech, and hopefully pick up a supporter or two. And, you know, there's no reason to drop out. So I think people are going to stick around even after the next round of debates. If they don't get on the debate stage, they can still campaign in Iowa. They'll still get some attention. There'll come a day of reckoning, but not for a few months. I mean, 5 months.
Just at least stay in until it gets cold. It's well, beautiful
yeah.
fall here.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's...
You don't want to miss out on football.
Well, right. Yeah, you come to Oktoberfest in the Amanas. You can, you know.
So over the past week, presidential candidates have been hitting the Iowa State Fair to speak at the Des Moines Register soapbox. So lots of candidates, lots of different messages. James, I know you've been there for a lot of them. Who stood out to you?
What really stood out to me was the crowds. That even people like John Hickenlooper or Steve Bullock were getting crowds, and the crowds that Elizabeth Warren and Pete Buttigieg and folks like that got were incredible for State Fair. And I think, you know, if I was Adam or chairman of the Republican Party, I'd be damn worried. Because Democrats are motivated, and there's really nothing going on the Republican side to get people motivated, to get them involved in this process.
Kind of going back to the State Fair, you know, not everyone is a fan of the fair as a venue for political candidates. Paul Waldman, an opinion writer for the Washington Post, said the fair is, quote, everything that is wrong with presidential politics, because the candidates are being judged on their authenticity while they're kind of being thronged by reporters as they eat corn dogs or whatnot. You know, Todd, I hear that you love the State Fair. What do you think of this criticism?
Well, I don't think much of it. I wouldn't buy that guy a corn dog. God forbid presidential candidates actually wade into crowds of real voters and talk to them in unscripted moments that aren't prepackaged by a consultant and tested in a focus group and polled to death. I mean, that's the nice thing about the State Fair is that you get it. I mean, a lot of Iowans got a chance to see presidential candidates that maybe aren't the Democratic activists that go to all of the events and things. They just maybe even came to the fair and happened upon the soapbox and thought, oh, what's going on? So you get a more varied crowd of people. You get a chance to get up close to some of these folks. You get maybe there are some young people there that were looking at this for the first time and have suddenly got excited about politics. I know when I was a kid, I was at the State Fair waiting for a corn dog, and Michael Dukakis butted ahead of me in line. And I thought, well, I'm going to commit my life to holding these jerks accountable. Butt in front of me in line. So, you know, I think it's... I mean,
he was getting the endive, right?
Yeah, exactly. Right. I don't. He probably put the wrong cheese on it or something. But I mean, it's a chance. I mean, the fair is kind of a Iowa's family reunion in a lot of ways, and so the fact that presidential candidates are crashing the family reunion, I think is a good thing.
I love, so there's this, okay, hold on, just follow me for a second. There's this literary theorist, Mikhail Bakhtin, who talks about these ideas of carnival, right? Where like these arenas, these festivals, where everything gets turned on its head, where kings are paupers and paupers are kings and everything's topsy-turvy, right? That's the fair. And that's why I think it's such a great place for politicians to come and sweat and smell stinky and have to glad hand babies and hang around bales of hay and try to politely nibble pork chops and eat a corn dog in a way that doesn't look disgusting. You know, it makes them be, it forces them to be real people, like real actual humans. And every 4 years we have to do this. We have to justify why Iowa? Why Iowa? Why are these guys so important? And that's the point. Yeah. We're not that important, and that's the point. We're regular people, so come be a regular person with us. You know, eat a funnel cake, be normal for 2 hot seconds, roll up your sleeves, look at a very large hog, and have a real honest conversation. And I don't know why this is such a hard concept to grasp, why we have to do this every 4 years. But look, if they want to do it every 4 years, I'll be here every 4 years to do it. And yeah, the Washington Post is dead wrong on that one.
Pose next to
And it wasn't their only bad take out of the fair, I'll just say that.
Pose next to a giant boar, but don't be boring. That's all we ask. That's all we ask.
And it's, I mean, you know, I think we've learned in the past several years that often who you are as a person is actually very important to the policies that you pass. We used to have this idea, it was like, oh, it's policy and then personality and the two never mix. Well, that's wrong. If you're a bad person, you're going to pass bad policies, Richard Nixon. So I really think that like maybe we should demand more authenticity of the people who are supposed to be representing us.
Why didn't we know better when Donald Trump showed up at the fair in a helicopter? Why did we not understand what was happening?
Who knew?
And how come none of the candidates this year are giving away free helicopter rides? Yeah. What's up with that?
So it's a special edition of River to River from the Gazette and Iowa Public Radio. We're at Millstream Brewing in Amana on what's turned out to be a lovely evening here in August. I'm Erin Jordan. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll delve into state and local issues, including sports betting and access to Iowa's ballot. Pints and Politics will be back in just a moment.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
We're back with the second half of Pints and Politics here at Millstream Brewing, and it's turned out to be a really nice night. There were some clouds kind of rolling in earlier. James and I were driving here from Cedar Rapids, and we thought, well, gosh, are they going to have to cancel? But it's turned into a really nice night here, and I'm glad to be spending it with you guys. So you may not have noticed it, but today is the first day sports betting is legal in Iowa. So I wondered, you know, we had a little primer, I think, today in the Gazette, or maybe it's coming in the paper tomorrow, about the basics of this. And James, I was hoping that maybe you could outline how this works a little bit.
Well, hand me your wallet. No, it started today at noon, the sports betting. Basically, you can go to a casino and place a bet there, or you can go to a casino and set up an account. So you can sit at home in your underwear and fuzzy slippers and place bets on your smartphone. So this is something that gambling interests wanted, the casinos wanted. It's not projected to be a huge revenue source for the state, although some states have found it to be quite quite a revenue source. New Jersey, for example, was the state that challenged the federal law against sports betting, and they've done quite well in the few months since it's started there. But in Iowa, it's not expected to be a huge boon to the state. But for people who like to bet on sports, it'll be fun. Mike Halas from the Gazette Sports Department is starting a podcast on sports betting, so you'll want to listen for that if you're interested in placing a bet or two. And I guess we're just going to have to kind of wait and see how this turns out, whether Iowans, whether Todd wants to place a bet or not.
I might. I was hoping that you would give us your picks for the first weekend of the college football season. Or I think Iowa State's favored by 3.5 at home over Iowa, so maybe you could tell us if that's we should take Iowa in the point, you know, Iowa State in the points or not. So
it'll be interesting. In general, sports books are not a huge revenue generator for casinos either. I think the house edge is usually about 10%, which is, I mean, if you could put in slot machines or sports betting, you would go with slot machines every time, where the house edge is 50% or something like that. But it'll be interesting to see how much casinos push this, how much they really want people to come in and do this, whether they're going to build really nice, fancy facilities for it or not. And the other thing I think is interesting is these online betting organizations are now going to have a footprint in Iowa, where they're going to... you know, they're going to have lobbyists and have a corporate footprint to some extent. And it'll be interesting to see if they put some pressure on to get other online gaming. So New Jersey, one reason they've had more online gambling revenues because they have, it's one of the only places where you can legally play poker online. It's just between y'all and me, it's really easy to illegally play poker online here in Iowa. But
he doesn't know any details.
That's what Todd told me before we started.
He read it on the internet.
But I'll be interested to see now that online gaming is an industry in Iowa, just the same way now that medical cannabis is an industry in Iowa. It's easy to see ways that it expands, and now that there's a lobby, it's really difficult to see ways that it contracts. And so I wouldn't doubt that within the next 5 years there might be more expansion of gambling.
What the casino lobby wants, the casino lobby gets. If I could just get the casino lobby to care about clean water, we'd be in great shape.
Well, if we'd left the casinos on the boats and not brought them on land.
Well, exactly. They might have not wanted to cruise through the algae blooms. So
Todd, you've given me the perfect segue to go to an audience question here. With the Republican leadership having sold out to big agriculture, what chance does Iowa have of getting clean water?
Chance of clean water. I mean, we're going on 10 years since the outdoor recreation or Natural Resources and Outdoor Recreation Trust Fund. They needed to find something snappier. Back in 2010, we didn't know about snappy branding.
I will.
Yes. And I mean, they passed pretty overwhelmingly and they still haven't filled it. And there isn't a lot of interest. It doesn't seem to fill it. So, I mean, that's sort of one vehicle that we could see increased funding for various programs. They passed a bill in 2018 that the governor signed, and there was much fanfare, and the fanfare isn't justified by the details of the bill, but I think there's a sense that we're going to stand pat on that, and it should be an election issue. I hope it's an election issue, but I know how state house elections go, and we'll probably be talking about how the Democrats want to let MS-13 into the state and socialism. So I'm not optimistic, but the problems are there. We know how to fix them. And it's going to take some political will to sort of both fund it and also potentially tell those who are responsible for the nitrate and phosphorus in our waters and then onto the Gulf of Mexico to tell them that they have to adopt at least minimum standards of care to try to hold some of that runoff back. Mm-hmm. But there's not much stomach for that right now.
Well, and the other thing that works against it is that the trust fund, they would have to raise the sales tax, and there's no appetite for raising the sales tax unless you're going to fund whatever my pet project is. So I don't see that as likely unless somebody out there has a grand plan and is a one heck of a negotiator that can bring people together around raising the sales tax to fill that trust fund. Because there are a lot of ideas on how to spend that money,
yeah.
And how to apply it to cleaning up the waters and improving outdoor recreation in Iowa.
Yeah, it's a careful what you wish for scenario too, because the fund is constitutional, but the formula for spending it is statutory, and there's been sentiment expressed by the Iowa Farm Bureau and others that they'd like to see that formula change to give all of the money to farm-based practices and take it away from recreational trails and things that people voted for in 2010. And so that would be a colossal battle were that to happen. And like so many things in the legislature, I have a feeling that formula would get written behind the scenes without a lot of input and would be sprang and passed before anybody could do much about it. So yeah, we want the fund filled, but you know, what's that formula going to look like, and how is that money is going to be spent is a bigger issue.
So changing gears a little bit, Iowa Libertarians filed a lawsuit in federal court last week to make it easier for them to get on the ballot. They say Iowa's law, which requires candidates who are not affiliated with the Democrats or Republicans to file in mid-March as opposed to August for the main party candidates. Adam, how significant is that extra time that that would be allowed to the GOP and the Democrats?
I think it's significant. So as you all probably know, Libertarian Party candidates are not really running to win races. They're running to grow their party and spread their ideas. And, you know, if you run this year and do poorly and then you run the next time and do a little bit better. But the thing is, to get somebody to do a mission that's not really a winnable mission, it's a hard ask to do. And then to ask them in January or February of an election year when nobody's thinking about their state house race is really difficult. What's frustrated me about this is this bill was supported by Democrats, but this provision was authored by Republicans. And so they're afraid that Libertarians will spoil their races, right? Because they peel off 1.5%, and the way they think about it, those are Republican votes. I don't think that's true. I think people who vote for Libertarians are Libertarians. They would probably stay home or write in if there was not a Libertarian Party candidate. So I think the Republicans are making a big miscalculation when they think that that the Libertarians are going to spoil races for them. And I would say I give the Democrats credit because some of them opposed this bill. But if there was a healthy Green Party or a healthy Socialist Party, which there's not in Iowa, I think probably Democrats would have supported it too. So it's easy to be cynical and partisan about it, but I think it's probably just circumstantial.
So on to election security. It was interesting to me to hear last week about this DEF CON conference in Las Vegas where hackers try to find vulnerabilities in computer systems. And also Vice reported that researchers have found private voting systems used in many states, including Iowa, have at times been connected to the internet, which leaves them vulnerable to hackers. What, if anything, are you hearing in Iowa about improving election security from the technology side?
My vast knowledge of technology will come to bear now. Well, we have had, I mean, locally, Linn County Auditor Joel Miller has complained that the state's voter registration database, the iVoter system, it's an old system. I think it's 14 years old or more. It needs to be updated. I mean, the Secretary of State's office acknowledges that there isn't the funding available to update it before the 2020 election, and that's a problem, because if there's going to be a vulnerability in our system, it's going to be that sort of online voter database that the counties use to determine who's eligible to vote and that the state uses. So it would seem to me older systems are more vulnerable. I think that's what the auditor is saying to some extent. So, you know, that's on the legislature too. Why is the legislature? I mean, we pass all sorts of tax cuts. We do tax credits. We do all sorts of things we spend money on. I think securing the voter registration database should be the sort of thing that maybe we could spare $6 or $7 or $8 million, which I've heard is what it's going to take to update that. I mean, luckily, as far as the hacking, we do have paper ballots in Iowa, which does help us secure our ballots. Some states don't have that, and I think that's where a lot of that concern is, because in Las Vegas, the hackers were able to pretty easily mess with those machines. So that's troubling.
Yeah.
I think part of the problem is that a lot of times when they've taken steps to improve election security, then it's like, okay, we've done that. But as we see with technology all the time, yeah, it's not a one and done sort of thing. There's always, you know, somebody trying to hack it. There's somebody trying to improve it. And so it's a continuous process with the election technology. And that's expensive. And, you know, legislators would prefer that we, you know, fix it once and then we're done with it for 10, 20, 50 years. But
not the voter ID laws. Those we keep fussing with over and over until the end of time, right?
Yeah.
Well, that's part of the problem in Iowa is that we've spent so much time and effort trying to make the voter ID law work and spending time in court that maybe we should have spent more time looking at this electronic voter registration system. It probably would have been smarter to spend that time and money on that. They've also had problems with the list of felons who are, you know, not eligible to vote. There are people that are on that list that were eligible to vote. There's some question about whether out-of-state felons are even being put on the list. Of course, if the legislature would follow Governor Kim Reynolds' lead, we wouldn't have to worry about that because we'd make felons eligible to vote, but after they've completed their sentences, but they don't seem inclined to want to do that.
So there was a great story in the Gazette this last weekend just about University of Iowa nurses having to wait wait times for their overtime pay. And a question from the audience, Iowa State employees under attack. How quickly can this be reversed? Is this the move? Is there any sort of movement to pay state workers more or to kind of get back to some of that, some of those bargaining rights that they had at one point?
No.
That story is just incredible, you know, about the University of Iowa hospitals and clinics waiting to pay nurses for overtime pay. So they're on they call it an extended pay schedule where they make them wait 6 weeks to get their overtime pay. And what's happening is nurses no longer then want to take those shifts because, you know, nurses, well, they can't put their daycares on extended pay. They can't put their rent on extended pay. And it's just another way for the hospital to make its budget look better on the backs of the nurses are 95% women, women who do the actual health care at the hospital. And, you know, these laws are not, or these rules are not affecting, you know, God forbid, the surgeons or the anesthesiologists, are they?
No.
And so it's just a really just insidious way of making a budget look better on the backs of the people who need the money the most. And that really great article in the Gazette talked about how it seemed like there would be a lawsuit perhaps maybe filed. I know there was a letter sent from a lawyer for the union. But, you know, this didn't just happen by accident. It happened because the GOP stripped collective bargaining rights for workers. And, you know, this wasn't just some like oopsies. This was a very intentional situation that happened. And now it's hurting the most vulnerable people who are the most critical points of care for Iowa. And Iowa's in a healthcare crisis. We don't have, you know, OB clinics are closing up all across the state. We don't have enough qualified doctors and nurses for rural areas. What does this say to the healthcare workers who were trying to get to come here? Like, come here, we just aren't going to pay you. Unless you're a surgeon, then it's fine.
I would add, the collective bargaining is certainly a factor, but I think the hospital doesn't have any cash on hand. Like, they've mismanaged these construction projects. The healthcare system is a mess for a lot of reasons. And so it's a lot of different issues here. I think they just don't have money to pay people with.
Well, and when the collective bargaining changes, gutting, whatever you want to call it, were passed, I mean, there was this talk about saving money. I didn't hear people say we're going to save money by not paying nurses. And, you know, and this is the thing. This is why bargaining matters. It's not that they want to portray this as state workers have these exorbitant contracts and all these benefits, and they're paid better than everybody else in the private sector. I mean, these are the rules of a workplace that are the difference between whether people are working in a healthy workplace or whether they're being exploited. I mean, that's why you negotiate contracts. And taking these rights away had real impacts on people that do work that we need them to do. And that's the unfortunate thing. And Liz is right. It makes the state less attractive in many ways for all sorts of professionals in the healthcare field and other fields to work here, and that it's done damage.
And it's also worth pointing out that nurses in Iowa make 23% less than the national average, the nurses in the national average. So we're already compounding a terrible problem.
I wanted to change gears a little bit, too. You know, traffic cameras have been controversial around the state, and especially in Cedar Rapids. This week, the city announced they would review tickets issued since early July after finding 12 that were wrongly issued because of a processing error. I wondered, you know, how badly does this ding the city's credibility about this program, or is it just, you know, a small speed bump?
I think if you're against the cameras like I am, then you see this and you're like, oh, well, that's stupid. That's one reason the cameras are bad. If you're for the cameras, you see that as, you know, one in many, many thousands of tickets that are issued, and you grant the government that leeway to make that kind of mistake. So I don't necessarily think that this those incidents make a big impact on public opinion about the cameras. And it does sound, honestly, like the city made the appropriate response. They dealt with it pretty quickly. They said it was an oversight. They're going to check it closer. So I don't think it changes the narrative, really.
What it does change is the arguments in the legislature to ban the camera. And you can say it's, you know, 0.1% were inaccurate or whatever. But the line in the discussion will be that, oh, they can't even, you know, get the tickets right. People who shouldn't get tickets are getting tickets, and so we should just ban cameras.
It does. The one thing that does need to be discussed is that it's a private company that administers this program, right? That I don't think we should be outsourcing. If it's a legitimate function of government, I don't think we should be outsourcing it to a foreign company, actually. Isn't it based in Europe? And so I think, and I don't know if that's where the oversight happened, if it was at Cedar Rapids PD or if it was at this company, but I think that's something we need to deal with, that if governments are going to do something, then governments should do the thing.
So a question from the audience, asking how the Democratic senatorial candidates are sizing up against each other, and these are the folks that are planning to run against Senator Joni Ernst. Are what are we seeing from them, you know, in terms of their positioning against each other in that primary challenge, or against what would be the ultimate competition against Senator Ernst?
I have to say I haven't seen a whole lot from any of them. They've been sort of making their rounds and appearing at events where, you know, all three of them are invited. Teresa Greenfield is the sort of the anointed one by the Democratic Senate Campaign Committee, and the other two, I guess, are just sort of wasting their time, according to Chuck Schumer. But, you know, it's Iowans haven't weighed in yet, so I guess we'll have to wait and see what Iowans think about these candidates. You know, we've talked before about this is going to be a very tough race for Democrats, you know. Joni Ernst is not going to be a pushover, so I'm not all that sure why any of them are lining up to go up against her.
Yeah, it seems like, you know, Joni's got a very strong foothold in the state, and people really like her, I think, especially through some of the things she's gone through in the past year, and it's garnered her a lot of sympathy and support. And also she's done this thing where she's been able to maintain a lot of like polite silence in a lot of the controversies that have been happening, especially with the Trump administration. She's kind of just like, she's not said a lot, which is actually kind of smart. So it does seem a little bit like you know, tilting at windmills to go right up against her, but, you know, I wish them the best.
So I wanted to finish off tonight. So I wanted to ask each of you on the panel if you have any ideas of what, you know, what would be nice to see on a custom-designed water tower.
You're a tough moderator. Usually Ben briefs us with the question so we can think of something funny to say.
I just thought of it. I'm sorry about that.
That is a great question.
I know we've got the smiley face. I think that's an Adair. Yeah. There's a tea kettle somewhere. Right.
The flying saucer, like up at Arlington or somewhere.
Yeah. I mean, what do you think might be some good ideas?
Well, there's always the ear of corn.
I think it should just say on the outside, it should say, clean water as far as you know.
Ask no questions.
Don't test it.
Should we leave it there? That was such a good one.
That was good.
Well, I want to end this evening by thanking Millstream Brewing for hosting and Bankhouse for sponsoring. As always, we appreciate our panel, Todd Dorman, Adam Sullivan, and James Lynch, and new for tonight, Liz Len. She did great, didn't she? Yeah. So thanks for coming out, and have a great night. Thank you.